CliffCentral.com.
All right, so yesterday Tito gave the medium-term budget speech. The little bits that I've heard about, because I didn't watch it, I've really fallen out of love with watching those. Pravin Gordhan put me off them because he's so boring to listen to. I could not. I watched Malusi because I wanted to see whether he could like string it together. And
dude, he was quoting Kendrick Lamar.
No.
Who the fuck?
Yeah. And what you would
and,
wear.
And he was a great finance minister. We all agree, right?
Moving right along.
The sweeping statements on the show. We all agree. Yeah. I don't know.
So one of the things that absolutely sucked, I wondered when they made him the finance minister if he was going to shut down his Twitter account. Because his Twitter account is old Tito.
Tito Mboweni.
Yeah. And then,
because I was thinking Malusi, all he does is fight with Ridit Labi. We leave that alone.
Hey, where are we on that 7-day countdown?
Who knows? I bet you he's fallen off the radar there. He can't even live up to his own promises, let alone the promises of the finance department when he was minister. The only promises that Malusi Gigaba seems to be able to deliver on is when he needs to give citizenship to the Guptas.
Ooh,
yeah, then suddenly he's very accountable.
He nailed that.
But anyway, you were saying, so Tito, he's on fire on his Twitter account. You were wondering if they'd shut that down.
If he would shut it down, because I would have shut it down. But then,
People are addicted to this stuff.
The problem with recycling ministers and recycling talent, right, is what does he do? Tips for Tito.
Oh, God. No new ideas. Mm-mm. All right, so this is what I have heard. I heard it from Pumi this morning. He says we've got to pay our e-tolls.
Not a good start.
Wait a minute.
I thought we'd already decided no one's paying that.
Except our dear friend, the good doctor, Cindy Van Sale.
Yes, she used to pay.
She still does.
Yeah, you know what? I feel the worst.
She's
for
insane.
People. Yeah, I feel the worst.
She must have medical issues.
I feel the worst for people who have been paying e-tolls, because you're never going to get that money back. And those of us who've never paid e-tolls, we're not going to have to give any money over. So who's going to get screwed? The good people who follow the rules, again.
Those e-tolls that you've been spending your money on, you're just covering bar bills. You might as well just buy a case of Johnny Blue at the beginning of the year and take it to a minister's house.
I mean, that's easier and more direct.
A lot more direct.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be supporting your local bottle store.
And you might even get a tender as a result of that
strategy. And it might actually be a better networking experience for you.
Although there is some good news.
Yes.
And this for me was a big one. We're getting there, but it's a big one.
All right.
That they're zero rating sanitary towels. They're not going to be VAT. They're going to scrap the VAT on
the tax on sanitary towels.
Yeah, they should be giving them away for free like they do with condoms. But hey,
it's a start.
Little fights.
It's a good thing. All right, and obviously that was always on the Womandla agenda as well.
It's always on the Womandla agenda.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I know you hate the idea of gender politics, but gender politics is important.
There are girls who can't go to school and who miss out on important parts of their life because they don't have the kind of stuff that really should be ubiquitous.
So if you think about the fact that it's 1 week out of every month, that means a quarter of the school year.
Mm-hmm.
There are girls who miss out on this.
Imagine.
Jeepers.
Imagine that. Imagine how that sets women back.
Imagine how that sets the world back.
Well, of course.
Because actually,
we're both important. Very important. We're in agreement on this. And whenever I say it, people think I'm some kind of gender activist. But it is just the truth that when you emancipate women in a society, and we've gone over this 100 times, so I'm not going to spend too much more time on it. But the minute women have control not only of their reproductive cycle, but are emancipated from men and the control of men, everything gets better. Everything in society gets better. The children's lives improve, the men's lives improve, and the women have agency and they have control over the direction of entire communities. It builds societies and civilizations in a way that no other single kind of emancipation does. Done deal. You can do as many searches online as you'd like. There are reports and studies that will back this up 100%.
Okay.
Thank you. There we go. I knew when Pumi came in, we'd have a little bit of activism. It's a good thing.
Yeah, this is your corner of Womandla.
Mm-hmm. We need it. This show has been very biased in the opposite direction for a very long time, right, Pumi?
Guys.
Jesus.
Yeah, guys. It's been very close to that moment of being trash.
But we, here you came.
I said we were trash from the beginning. I said we were trash long before that stupid hashtag came up. And by we, I mean me and Ben and Sia.
Speak for yourselves.
All right. Yeah. Couple of stories in the news. What do we want to get to first?
Do you want to do a bit of a court update in the story of Hannah Cornelius, the Stellenbosch student?
Gosh, this is a horrible story. I only heard about it for the first time yesterday because I didn't know this.
Turn your stomach, the story.
I was away. Just remind me, this is some girl who was attacked by three guys.
Mm-hmm.
She had her head smashed in with a rock by three attackers. Now, you know, we talk about the violence against women in South Africa, and we talk about, you know, the hideous rape statistics that we have, and we talk about how many ugly assaults happen for women every day. The count is something like every 4 seconds. It's just awful. And then we hear a story like this, which is so brutal. I mean, a head smashed in with a rock. Jesus. And the guy who was arrested has pled guilty, and he gave all the grisly details.
He really was just...
All four of them. So there were four, because I heard there were three.
There were four guys.
And I heard one of them bust all the others and said, yeah, this is what happened.
Yeah, that's Geraldo Parsons, who really just let everything loose in his testimony in court yesterday. He just spoke about the fact that Hannah Cornelius was stabbed because she refused to get out of the boot of her hijacked car. And this is Geraldo Parsons, who's accused of her murder, as he testified in the Western Cape High Court yesterday. Geraldo ended up basically painting the rest of the group as the masterminds behind this. He just says he went along with things because it wasn't even their intention to do this. They said they were just out on the town and they were just...
So he's a murderer and a snitch. Exactly.
And trying to get himself off lighter in this. He says that they were just planning on going out on the town for a stroll and to casually plan to rob people. I love how a casual stroll and robbing can be in one sentence. But okay, Geraldo. Geraldo also then claims he and co-accused Ibn Funikerk had been walking around to pass the time as they were waiting for their wages to be paid into their account back in May of 2017. And this is when they spotted Hannah Cornelius's car and they robbed her and her friend, and they wanted to steal the car to sell it for drugs. And yeah, these are just some of the details that he released yesterday in court. It's grisly, it's just grimy, it's horrible. It's a horrible, horrible story. Yeah.
Okay, so he's spilled the beans.
And the trial is expected to conclude within the next couple of days.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Sia. We were trying to have a nice day, but there's that story.
Guys, let's take a pinch of it all. A pinch of it all.
I know we're going to talk to Anthea about the medium-term budget speech a little later on, and that's probably going to be a lot more content interesting and filled by Anthea than it will be by me. But the fact is that Tito Mboweni did say one other thing that I think bears a little bit of interest and probably deserves a bit of our attention. He said we need no more than 25 people in cabinet.
So who would you call first?
Oh, there's so many. Are you kidding?
Go straight.
Yes. If you had the machete.
Now, well, firstly, every deputy minister.
No need.
That would be a start.
We only need one political head for a department.
And so then every deputy minister goes. How many ministerials?
That's already, we've got it down to 35 already.
Okay. Just think, the traffic, Bumi, and if nothing else. You take away those blue lights, half that as well.
Yeah. That's a good point. And then you go for the personalities who we know are crooked and rotten and were part of state capture. So you immediately go for Batabile Dlamini, you go for Malusi Gigaba, you go for, I think maybe Tulas Ngesi tried to cover himself in glory by doing one or two things right after doing a lot of things wrong. So maybe he shouldn't be on the hit list.
Yeah, but
who else is
Gareth, you have to kill departments, because if you're going to get rid of
enough.
A person, they'll
just
be
fair enough.
Replaced.
All right, so I'm going after the people, which is wrong. You should go after the departments. Well, why is there a department?
Which one are you thinking
why of? Is there a department of communications and a department of telecommunications? And
why can't they be
they
combined
they
into one?
There used to be one, but then Jacob Zuma had to find a job for one of his pals who he'd promised something to or who was covering his backside, and so he created a whole new department. So that can be fixed immediately. Do we need this very. I'm going to ask Pumi this one. Do we need a department for women, children, and the disabled? And do those three have anything in common? Tell me.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Well, the one thing they all have in common is that they're very much marginalized. But I don't know if we
children?
Need children.
Marginalized? Yo. Most spoilt. They don't work. They don't contribute to the tax base. They're parasites.
Because they can't marginalized. Work. Oh, you always think they have tiny hands, so they should dig
they should
in
be in mines. I knew it. And they're fixing the little things like the Chinese children do. Look at their economy.
Oh, great example. Shining example.
Shining example. Cease, Gareth. Cease.
Do you think that department should be there? And what have they ever done for anyone?
So I don't think that department should be there, but that department really doesn't quite exist because they don't have a budget outside of salaries. But they can't do anything. So they should
the
be collapsed into social services.
Right. Okay, how about Ministry of Small Business? We know they do nothing for small business.
But they should be there. They just need to work because we need small businesses to thrive in this country.
Why do we need?
But that's the job. So for me, that's the job of trade and industry. That's the job of treasury.
Good point.
It's not a single thing on its own. And I think that the work that needs to be done for small business, and as you can see, Ben, I'm almost as passionate as you and that cricket.
Greatest South Africans.
Right. Okay, well, guys,
those policies sit at treasury where we should be cutting the kind of taxes and giving incentives to small businesses. That's
completely.
At treasury. At
as a small business owner, right? You understand this. That's all they need to do.
Yeah, and just and cutting down the paperwork for all of this.
Do less,
stuff.
Not more.
Okay, so what does the Department of Cooperative Governance do?
And why they are that? Supposedly the link between provincial, municipal, and national governments. We don't need them either.
Okay, so there's the Department of Service and Administration, plus there's the Department of Service Commission.
And there's a Department of Public Enterprises and a Public Works Department. And pretty much they could all be put into one department.
Yes, if you just did public jobs, you could really tighten this up.
The state infrastructure, or whatever you want to call it. But that could all be one. So now we must be down to about 15.
So 25, actually, we can up it, Mr. Mboweni.
Well, he says, and this is I'm going to quote directly from Tito Mboweni here. He said, if he asked me about the size of the cabinet, talking about the president, I would say preferably not more than 25. Probably 20 is an ideal, said Mboweni.
What's the department of the presidency? Can't the president just be the president? Why must there be a department of presidency?
Yeah, you can have a spokesperson and a secretary and a...
Why must there be a department about this?
China is a big economy, says Tito, and I think they have about 25 ministers. We have no economically, financially, and politically understandable reason that you can have an executive that's up to 70 people. That is what I would say to him. Mboweni said the public wage sector bill, or sector wage bill, accounted for 35% of consolidated government expenditure. It's what you call a parasitic new elite. That's what that is. He called on government departments to be strict in their management of overtime payments, promotions, and improvement of other conditions of service.
They have overtime payment?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so at the... Oh, gosh... almost sounding...
You're being very trepidatious.
Because I'm about to sound like such a geek, right? The thing that really sucks for me about Tito and his utterances is really the realization of how much like neoliberal bullshit we have to deal with him, the ANC as a whole. All right. Crazy. It's actually crazy. So
what is he
even
not
as
saying?
He then says this, so he gives with the right hand and takes with his left hand. On the one side, he says, yeah, we must cut these government departments. We don't need so many people. Great. We love that, right? And then in the same breath, he then says, ESCOM has got to cull 30,000, I don't know, however many kind of jobs. And for me, that is so reckless. It's so reckless as a minister. To come out and just make provisions and pronouncements and not give us a clear plan or put... How are you supposed to feel when you are a person that is employed currently in the economic climate that we are in and you are working at ESCOM and suddenly the minister says we're going to cut down this number of jobs with no clear plan, right? So now you're supposed to go to work every day and do what?
Yeah.
And be productive? and make sure that the lights are on. It's reckless. It's absolutely reckless.
Words, tell us how you're going to do it. We understand it has to be done, but explain it to us.
Yeah, and also don't do not then take another 2 years to make it happen. If you're going to make it happen, make it happen. Unfortunately, I also believe that if we're going to do something about the way that our economy is and our government saying we've got to create jobs, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, there's so many things that we can do already. I think it's extremely reckless to have outsourced everything in government. You know, the public works used to be a thing where they employed a whole number of people to cut the grass on the side of the freeway. To all of those things have now been outsourced, so they go undone.
Yeah.
Right? You spend
usually to very shady and dodgy tenders that seem never to get the work done.
Yeah. And in an environment like the one we have now, you almost feel like you want to find yourself back in a situation where, I mean, in America, when they had the Great Depression, one of the things that they did, you know, was big infrastructure projects. Mm-hmm. And what those infrastructure projects did is they gave people work. They gave people meaningful things to do with their time and with their skills. Then we have to have a conversation about, do we have the skills for big public infrastructure programs here in South Africa?
You know, the answer is not going to be a resounding yes.
Yeah, and we've got Kadar Asmal to blame for that. But hey.
Mm, sure.
Wow, Pumi's setting fire to a lot of... She's just wiped out three departments all on her own in that little diatribe.
I told you that makes me sound like a geek. You know, on a side note to everybody that's listening to us, I'm actually a very fun person.
No, she is. So Pumi Mashiko, in case you recognize, you recognize the voice, but you're not entirely sure where she comes from. Pumi is a well-known media personality. She had her own TV show called Tswaraganang a long time ago, and she has her own very busy ad agency and her own business that she's been running. And apart from that, she was also the host of Womandla, and we decided it was time to get her in here. High time, in fact.
I miss Womandla.
I know. You want to bring it back from being in mothballs.
I do. I love that show. It was the Lord's work, Gareth.
The Lord's work?
The Lord's. I thought it was your work.
Sounding like one of our pastors now in South Africa.
The work All right. of the Lord.
So a few things that I wanted to get cleared up today, and we can get into some of the news stories a little bit later on, the stories you might have in your mind, and you know what to do. Call us on 0861-555-189. We're going to have a guest pop by just now. I'll tell you who that is and what exactly he has to say. He can say for himself, but I'll try to give you an idea of where we're going. We also got Peter Dirk Ace popping in. He's written a brilliant book called The Echo of a Noise, memoir of then and now. It's incredible.
It's so much fun.
Such a great guy. And this is an incredible book, by the way, because, you know, if you are at the stage in your life where you can write an autobiography like this, or a memoir, as he's termed it,
The difference, by the way?
Well, a memoir is more his recollection of things. So it's told from his point of view only. Autobiography tends to be more straying into the area of this is how objectively my life looked. A memoir is more like his feelings, his thoughts, that kind of
thing. I just like memoir because I feel like I need to say it as I clutch my pearls.
Yes, it's very much a Sia word.
My memoir.
Memoir.
If you're wondering where the burning platform is today, we were going to be joined by a very renowned journalist in South Africa. She's going to join us tomorrow on the burning platform. Unfortunately, she told us early this morning she had to cancel, so she'll be back a little later on this week, as in tomorrow. All right, what else is going on?
Gareth, there's a Me Too movement documentary.
Ah.
So apparently there's a filmmaker that wanted to kind of do some stuff and heard some whispers around Harvey's stuff. And he was silenced. And apparently he believes that there's actual journalists that were working for Harvey.
Huh.
As in telling certain stories and suppressing others. And it's all going to come out. There's a documentary. The documentary is called, wait for it, The Reckoning.
So this person basically had a handle on Me Too before it became
the popular movement. Yeah, I understand that there's things going on, but they're being swept under the Hollywood carpet. It's a very big carpet.
Okay.
I want to thank Harvey and Bob Weinstein.
I would like to thank Harvey Weinstein.
Harvey Weinstein, who believed in us and made this movie.
Harvey Weinstein. Thank you, Harvey Weinstein.
And God. Harvey Weinstein.
And God.
He left the room. This time, he came back fully naked. Am I gonna Is he gonna rape me?
Gwyneth Paltrow did it. Renee Zellweger did it. Charlize did it. He's like, it's very simple. They know if they don't do certain things, you ain't working again. Because you heard the stories of, like, don't be alone with Harvey.
More than whispering. I mean, the first time I met Harvey, he came in very aggressive. He said, what have you heard about me? And I said, I've heard you rape women.
It was allowed to go on because he had so much power. If he was some schmuck in a mailroom, he would be in jail.
Nearly 60 women now accuse him of misconduct, ranging from sexual harassment to rape. He victimized everybody.
We're all sitting around every day, we're wondering who's next. There will be glass broken. Well, there's no time for due process because the public is the judge and jury.
24 hours later, the Me Too tweets are in excess of 1.2 million tweets from women around the world.
Wow, the reckoning, huh? How does that sound? Doesn't that sound interesting?
But Ben, what are the claims? The claims are that Harvey had journalists working for him.
Yeah, there's rumors that Harvey had journalists that would obviously just shut people up or pressure people into not saying things.
So his own team of spin doctors.
We know that he threatened people.
Yeah.
He threatened them directly, and he must have had other people threatening them directly.
He had so much influence. Like, there's talk about him like buying movies and just binning them. Before, because they had the money and the influence. Like, if this guy was going to touch a few kind of hornets' webs, nests, sorry, then Harvey would just kill the production.
He'd buy the movie and just throw it away.
Yeah.
Wow.
I can't say I'm shocked by this, though.
No.
Money, power, and a horny person.
But see, but the thing is, like, with all of these things, we can read as much as we want. We can take in all these different stories. We need to see something. We need a video. We need a movie to really bring it home.
Yeah, because people don't want to actually read.
It's like people need a movie for everything in life. And now finally the Me Too movement has actually got to act together. Right. Now there's a movie for it. And then everyone's going to go, okay, yeah, so he really, really was a creep.
Sure.
Well, as well, it was a few months ago, someone had already bought the rights to this whole Me Too story and was going to make a fictional movie around it. These things happen so quickly, so fast, but... I'm telling you, Harvey's probably still in a robe somewhere. He's now, I don't know, probably in Europe, living
apparently
on the top of an estate.
Apparently, he actually never used to come out in the robe. He used to just come out fully naked.
Ugh. I mean, what on earth? What are you thinking when you look like Harvey and you reckon that's going to be the thing that turns the girls?
But how about that for a reputation? Hey, you rape women. That's what people. Jeez. That's Harvey, the raper of women.
That's the first thing that journalist said. She said to him when she saw him, "What have you heard about me?" He asks. I've heard you rape women. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Morning, guys.
What's happening, man?
So, Ben, I've got a conspiracy theory for you.
Okay.
So, I don't know if you guys actually read my WhatsApp yesterday about what's this guy that got chopped up, Khashoggi?
Khashoggi.
Khashoggi.
Khashoggi. That guy.
Yeah.
So, do you guys know what the petrodollar is?
Yeah, the cost of oil, yeah?
Does it ever come to your mind why are we, I mean, our world comes from Saudi Arabia and, but why is the currency of trade dollar?
Well, because America probably uses more of it than anyone else.
Wait, why is the, what was the question? Why is
why
the currency?
Why is called the petrodollar instead of like, why is it not the petro euro or the
So I'm gonna try and make it as short as I can.
All right.
There's a standing agreement between, and it goes back to Nixon, between Saudi Arabia and America, that as long as the house of Saud is, as long as they trade in dollar and in no other currency, America will protect house of Saud. If you think back to the days of
by that you're referring to the Saud, the Al Saud family that rule Saudi Arabia.
Yes, correct. Okay. So if you think back, about Saddam Hussein and those guys, Saddam Hussein at some stage wanted to change that, and he wanted to trade in euros.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, America was up there looking for weapons of mass destruction, and Saddam Hussein saw his arse. The same thing with Gaddafi. Gaddafi also wanted a different currency to trade in oil, and Gaddafi then got taken out by the Americans as well. And both these guys If you think about Saddam Hussein, he was a far right Islamist, right?
All right. So, look, a lot of these things I've heard some of these in bits and pieces, and part of what you're saying is obviously true in terms of the historical fact of Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi. But how does this link to Khashoggi?
So that guy was also a far right Islamist, and he doesn't agree with the way that this new prince of war, whatever he's called, mm-hmm. of Saad, is running the country. I mean, he's letting women drive and. And I think this chap had information with regards to that agreement mm-hmm. between America and Saudi Arabia. And he was putting that in jeopardy. He was probably going to leak something, and hence the fact that he got killed.
All right, so they killed him. They killed him to silence him so that the U.S. can continue to fund the Al Saud family and keep them in place in Saudi Arabia.
Correct.
Right, but that's not so much a conspiracy theory. We sort of know that that's true. We sort of know that the Americans have been selling arms to Saudi Arabia. They're probably the biggest purchaser of arms in the world. We also know that the Saudi royal family have deep connections into American politics. And we know that, for example, on 9/11, one of the only planes that was allowed to fly away was a family of the Saudis, the royal family, who left in a huge hurry because, of course, Osama bin Laden was a Saudi as well.
And it's very interesting that you mentioned that, Gareth, because if you think back to Saddam Hussein's time,
mm-hmm.
if America had to go to Saddam and say to him, look, I mean, it's all a game of chess, and they said to him, who is your biggest nemesis at this point, your biggest problem at this point? Saddam would probably have said, if I think about it, there's a rebellion starting and this guy is getting, things are getting out of hand. It would have been Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
The perfect person to blame 9/11 on.
Yeah, but you're also referring to a much bigger and much more long-standing conflict between Sunni and Shia Islam. Mm-hmm. You're talking about who controls the sphere of influence. This is something we touched on Monday. When the Renegades came in, or Tuesday this week, I think you're onto it. It's not so much of a conspiracy theory, but there are quite disparate links when you bring in Saddam, who was obviously an enemy of the Americans. So it would have been to Saddam's advantage to disrupt that, but he never could. I mean, he was attacking Kuwait unprovoked long before America decided he was an enemy. And
anyway, guys. Yeah. That's
all right.
All I have
you
to
see,
say,
now you've all right. You've lost interest too. All right. Thanks. Bye. Okay. Bye. Bye.
And the amount of debt that America has with the Saudis. I mean, that's just.
By the way, this is a cabinet meeting of the Saudi royal family. They're busy deciding on the budget for next year. This is a live feed. All right, thank you very much. There we go. That was provided courtesy of Al Jazeera.
Oh, reliable news.
Well, one of the few. All right, what else is going on? Anything you want to throw in before we bring our guest in?
If we were talking about Tito and the budget a little earlier, did you hear about how much he had to say at the press briefing afterwards? He was basically lamenting about how much he was paid back when he was working in the private sector. Yet
he was complaining about his government salary?
I mean, like,
no. So he was
speaking
actually saying,
out so much.
Oh, you know, well, again to the Twitter account, because some months ago he was like, I'd never take the job to be a finance minister. And what he was actually saying, how he was actually enjoying his life so much more.
Mm. Yes.
But this is his country duty. He's come back to save their day.
What a hero.
Were we all meant to bow down at this thought? He says he was paid so much and he used to work way less than
he
does now.
He used to have Thursday to Sunday was his weekend.
Thursday to Monday even. Yeah, Thursday to Monday off.
Wow.
He highlighted how great his life was on the farm. He has tons of animals to take care of. His staff would even grow, and I love that he calls it, his staff used to grow the green leaf that has now recently been the subject of a constitutional court ruling.
He was growing weed.
Finance minister?
Yeah, he did
say
it belonged to the gardener.
All right. Like, what are you saying? So perhaps you're onto something, Sispumi. Maybe account isn't for him.
Such a housewife thing to say. Oh, that's not me. That belongs to the gardener.
I know.
Housewife, huh?
And about his goats, he was also bragging about the land he has.
He says, back then, I had more time with my lambs, dogs, chicken, cabbage, and spinach.
Oh, wow.
It just sounds
too Well, there
bizarre.
He is. That's your finance minister, everybody. We'll find out more when Anthea pops in about 15 minutes' time. You can get all you need to know about taking care of your furry family members here at cliffcentral.com. We have an excellent series, a 10-part podcast series brought to you by Pet Heaven, and it is called Pause for Thought. Pet Heaven, of course, South Africa's leading online pet food delivery service. I use them. It's not a paid for endorsement. I use them because I don't want to go to the shops to buy dog food. Is there any more boring thing you could do with your time? I love my dog, but who wants to go to the goddamn pet shop to buy food?
Dude, I need that.
Right?
Gareth, what else is really bothering you right now?
Well, it's just a waste of time. So these guys deliver it for you, and you can even decide how often you want them to. So if you use up a bag in 2 months, the next month it's there.
They just show up.
You don't have to think about it. You just schedule the deliveries. It's great. And Leanne Moll is the host of Pause for Thought. You can find out about nutrition, socializing your dog, traveling with your pets, puppy training, common health issues, pet insurance, and so much more. All 10 episodes are available now. You can download them on cliffcentral.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just look for Pause for Thought. That's P-A-W-S, in case you hadn't worked that one out. Pet Heaven is an online-only pet supplies business offering recurring deliveries to keep your pets regularly fed, exceptional customer service, and competitive pricing on all their brands. Check them out at PetHeaven, PetHeaven.co.za. That's PetHeaven.co.za. You can thank me later. All right, are you ready to meet? You know, I was actually blown away when you walked in here now, Chotsi. You look, yeah, well.
thank you for that, I guess.
No, I mean, look, I'll read your CV to people in a second, because you are by no means someone we shouldn't know about. But when you walked in, I mean, you look just like your father.
In a good way or bad way?
No, in a good way.
Because some people think of it as a bad way, of like a target on me immediately.
No, dude. I went to your dad's book launch.
Yeah.
And I thought he you know, did a great job of explaining to us what happened to poor old Thabo Mbeki.
Yeah.
But
poor old Thabo Mbeki.
Yeah, your dad, Frank Chikane, who we all know well. We're talking to Chotsi Chikane, who is a man who's got quite an interesting story to tell.
Yeah.
Some of the politics that he went into in the Must Fall movements. He's just written a book called Breaking a Rainbow, Building a Nation. And it covers the university protests that took place in 2015 through to probably now. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
You know those. They're called the Fees Must Fall protests, and they've changed quite a lot about the world of tertiary education and even the politics of modern South Africa. He's written this book about what happened prior to the protests, what led to the events of October 2015 at the various university campuses and nationally. The book is a four-part retelling of what happened on the ground among students. First at Roads Must Fall, then moving to the university responses and management, and what ultimately led to the Fees Must Fall nationwide protests. So welcome, man.
Yeah,
and congratulations on the book. It's about time we had someone write about this important and seminal event.
Yeah, well,
series of events.
Well, trying my best, I guess.
No, you're doing well.
Yeah, we'll see.
What made you want to cover this? I mean, what got you interested in it?
The brutal honest truth. There's an individual called Tim Crow at UCT, Professor Emeritus in biology, something along those lines. He's the guy who wrote an article comparing the student protest to the Taliban, which is an interesting time of our lives. South Africa was going through a weird period at that time. And he got a few of his colleagues, they came together, and this is about 4 months after Fees Must Fall, and published the book called Fees Must Fall, which was I don't want to call them right wing, because that's not the appropriate tag, just very conservative white males who wrote very disparaging remarks about Fees Must Fall from their perspective, which people are allowed to do. But it was a bit frustrating that the first book about Fees Must Fall came from this particular grouping.
A criticism.
Yeah. And then the other criticism is, well, students will write eventually. But a lot of the students who are writing went straight to, like, academic journals. Now,
well, at the moment, aren't we still dealing with students who are facing prison sentences?
Yeah.
As a result of those
Protests. Yeah, across the country. If the Department of Constitutional Development and Justice, I think it is, tells us they're 100 people, whatever the name
Michael
is
Masuta.
Now.
Michael
If they can tell us the exact number, that would be fantastic, but it's a huge number. Though, good news, though, about two or three students yesterday did their 3 years of community service.
Okay. They've completed it already.
Yeah, completed it. It has been
on and off. Are they better people now? Are they able to do more
if
for others?
If you told them, let's go protest tomorrow, I think they'll probably be like, yes, let's go do this thing.
Okay. So nothing has been changed.
No. No, until the underlying issues change, I think people will still be on standby waiting for the next blow up of sorts.
So you are not afraid of controversy because in this book you write, among other things, about how they're different from 1976.
Yes.
They may be education, you know, centered in terms of the specifics of their grievances, but in many ways these are completely different protests. They come from completely different places. The people who are protesting now have a very different worldview and list of grievances to the people in 1976. Just explain a little bit about that.
Well, the biggest one is this boiling tension with one of the big narratives, this Rainbow Nation narrative. I use it as like a catch-all phrase to essentially say, young people, be happy that apartheid is over, build the country now. And we say, yes, we want to, but there's these huge impediments in our way that are linked to this Rainbow Nation narrative of everyone should be unified. And that's what makes us slightly different from 1976.
I need this explained because I'm sure not the only one. Why are there so many people who would prefer a narrative that isn't about unity, that would prefer a narrative that makes it look like the Rainbow Nation was a sham?
Yeah.
That would like to take the legacy of people like Nelson Mandela, the guy who coined the phrase Rainbow Nation, Desmond Tutu, and a number of others.
Jesse Jackson coined the term.
Was it Jesse?
Oh my God!
Jesse Jackson
really
did
is
come
the king
through.
Of all
he's the one who pulled through.
Jesse Jackson.
Well, correction. God bless Reverend Jesse Jackson.
All right.
So let's give credit where credit's due. Thank you, Pumelele.
Yeah.
So why are people so opposed to that narrative? What about that narrative is offensive to people who would prefer, and I want to know what they would prefer.
Yeah. So I actually think the Rainbow Nation narrative is the perfect description of the country, just the metaphor itself, right? So everyone knows what a rainbow looks like.
Multicolored. All works together.
Yeah, kind of. But the colors never intersect.
No.
They run in parallel with one another into infinity, constantly. And that's a perfect description of our country, of we are united in our diversity, but we never recognize our differences by interacting. We just run in parallel in our spaces. And when we do interact, and now you're going to hear my student politic terms, there's always this white hue between the colors. And this white hue I use as my metaphor is these white spaces where people interact. And those are the dominant places where you find racial interaction. And I say, cool, we could have that metaphor, but it means we'll forever be running in parallel with each other. What the student protest, at least at the beginning, and there's a lot of changes that happened, at the beginning was saying, we don't want to simply be unified if we don't recognize why we are different. And recognizing why we're different allows us to understand each other better.
This is identity politics.
It is identity politics with class politics with a small
smorgasbord. Is it intersectionality?
So here's the funny thing. So at the beginning of Rhodes Must Fall, and you can trace Fallism before Rhodes Must Fall, but I'll use Rhodes Must Fall, intersectionality wasn't there at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. So Rhodes Must Fall simply came in and said, so there's a statue, it makes us feel bad. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm simplifying things. There's a statue makes us feel bad.
That's pretty much the crux of the
That was the heart of everything. But as the ideology only grew as we started arguing with each other. Mm-hmm. So intersectionality came in once the woman in the movement said, We've seen this game before. We've read our history. Every time black men gather around and fight for justice, they always push black women aside. We refuse to play this game with you. We are going to change the narrative. So you get what we call the black radical feminism coming in. Mm-hmm. Black radical feminism will come with intersectionality into the argument. It was never there from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with black consciousness. At the very, very beginning, it wasn't a black conscious movement. It was a contestation of ideas that said, cool, bring black consciousness in. Same with Pan-Africanism. Often people are just like, oh, the students had this ideology from the get-go. Most of the time it came from 8 hours of a plenary. Sitting down, arguing
a
point.
Sounds like a waste of time.
And sitting there and being like, oh my God, why can't we get to the point? And then you'll have this one person who drops just a little bit of wisdom saying, why didn't you say that 7.5 hours ago? that would have saved us a lot of time. But you see these interactions, and that's how you get things such as intersectionality coming in. That's how you get people understanding what it means to recognize someone else's difference, because that's really what people wanted at the beginning.
But Rukhotsofe, isn't this the point of Varsity?
Why are you using his full name? We can call him Khotsi.
No, I just you know love him. His name.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, I know. I like it too.
Your name.
Go for it. Sorry, I interrupted you.
But the point of student politics, the point of scholarliness is exactly that.
Yes.
It's about debate. It's about moving forward. It's to get the forward thrust is you need the varying ideologies clashing.
Yeah.
That's why we need them. That's why we need them.
Well,
all the way back to when parliaments were formed. That was the point of it, is you want the different people's different views to have an opportunity to ferment.
Yes.
And that way we are able to move the entire society forward.
So I take a very different view on this notion of decolonization from most people. So most people have two camps. They say decolonization is, oh, they want to get rid of colonial legacies. And the other reason is decolonization want to uplift African narratives. And I say, neither one of those two really fit my mindset. In my mind, decolonization is there should be no arbitrary upliftment of a person's argument. Every person's argument should be challenged on the merits of that argument.
Well, I think in that case, you'd have most of academia behind you as well.
Right, but the problem was academia failed to acknowledge that certain knowledge bases were arbitrarily being lifted above others.
Mm.
So if you came into a room and people ask, let's study, here's a good example at UCT. Let's study medical anthropology.
Right.
And they say, well, how do we have the African opinion on medical anthropology? And the question is, how do you ask that when one of the greatest professors at this university was A.C. Jordan, Paolo Jordan's dad at the time?
Now, he was an actual doctor as opposed to Paolo Jordan, who was a fake doctor.
He was an interesting guy. But A.C. Jordan comes out and he's one of the foremost writers about how medical anthropology in the Eastern Cape. He just wrote in a different way. Now, the question is, his knowledge base has been affirmed. He was a lecturer at the University of Cape Town in the middle of apartheid, when apartheid gave zero whatever about black academics. He went off to go to the university, Columbia University, etc., etc. Why isn't his writing being studied? And the question was, why is the old white person's narrative being arbitrarily uplifted over an African narrative? So,
but isn't that more of an embarrassment then to black people who haven't learnt about him than it is to the white people who supposedly are arbitrarily lifting their own studies?
If the white people were never told about it.
I'm sure there's Native American medicine in America too, but it's not curing people.
So it would be a big thing if the university was never told about it. So I do detail in the book of moments after 1994, a professor called Mahmoud Mamdani comes out to the university and says, we have to change your curriculum. I'm not going to fundamentally alter it and say we only want African narratives. He says there has to be a balance and a better understanding of the African narrative within a university context. There's a whole hoo-ha about it. It's called the Mamdani Affair. And so that in academia, if anything's called an affair, it's always linked back to that. If there's a scandal amongst academics, it's the Mamdani Affair or the Habib Affair of some sort. And the Mamdani Affair, essentially, was Mamdani's foremost African academic, one of our biggest African academics, was essentially kicked out of UCT because UCT refused to acknowledge his views of we need a balanced narrative in the curriculum.
But this sounds like politics in science, which is always confounding to me because science doesn't care about politics or your feelings. I mean, science is objectively right or wrong.
So science is objective.
I mean, this sounds like leftist postmodernist nonsense, where everything's made up. Where everything's made up.
Post-development.
Yeah, but you know, this is what I'm saying: is where everything's made up. It's all structural. It's all political, and we know that's nonsense. I mean, if you get cancer, there's no amount of structural change you can do to the university or to the hospital that will take the cancer away.
Yeah. So I understand
this when it comes to the humanities. It makes perfect sense, and that's why it's a stupid thing to study humanities, because you're never going to read
humanities alone.
No. But
the humanities has allowed me to get to it.
No. So science is different.
No, it's not. Science.
How so?
Science is similar to the humanities. Is a construct, and construct. All constructs can
gravity,
be broken.
Gravity,
science fiction. Science fiction, right?
It's not science.
But things that start out as wild thoughts that could never be have to be which is what science does, is you hypothesize, you come up with protocols, you test the theory,
and
then they become concrete and they become real.
Well, we try to all test them under laboratory conditions to make sure that they are objectively true.
It's a belief system. You've got to start from a particular point and work through it. The thing about science is that you can, in some of them, get absolutes, similar to humanity, similar to politics, similar
to
religion.
In the humanities.
Similar to religion. Everything is moving at a particular point.
So I can add, so with the sciences, I would agree. Gravity is gravity.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't change.
Whether it was discovered
by
Karl Marx or it was discovered by...
But, here's the big but, and this is the big fight I used to have with the engineering professors of, cool, like, physics is physics. But people are still political animals regardless. And the issue is not with Newton's first principles. The issue is with the lecturer teaching Newton's first principles.
Yeah, but this sounds like those Republicans in America who say climate change doesn't exist in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary.
So this is not to
just
say...
Just because politically it's convenient for them to say
I think those are two different arguments. The argument of saying climate change is a falsity and us saying the first Newton law is a fallacy. That we're not saying that. We're saying that exists.
Neither of us are scientists, so this is all conjectural. Get back to Fees Must Fall, because actually it doesn't matter what our opinions on science are. It doesn't. We don't have a valid opinion.
All the doctors are
looking
at us.
Correct.
Like, you need
they think
degree.
We're morons.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. You've written this book. What I'm interested in is these activists, these people who brought about this change, have you tracked their progress since the noise at the beginning?
Mm.
Because we know that this had real effects. I mean, there was a march on the Union buildings.
Yep.
The president made a speech.
Yep.
We had free tertiary education promised.
Yeah, apparently.
So to all intents and purposes, Fees Must Fall was wildly successful.
Yeah.
Is that how you appraise it now, having done the research, which again I admire because so many people already have opinions on this without having read as much as you have about it?
Yeah. So my supervisor makes a valid point about the 2015 protests. There's different victories for each year. 2015 was a huge victory because there are no examples in the world where in the span of a week, an agitation is made by citizens, and by the end of that week, the demand by the citizens is met by national government through the president making an announcement of some sort of policy change. Now, that's never been heard of. That is a victory that students should keep in their back pocket forever. 2016 is a bit more different because then we shift the goalposts, and we did shift the goalposts quite often.
Right.
We shifted it from 0% fee increment to 0% fee increment for working class students to a free decolonial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It kept shifting.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with that, but it allowed us to get into this false sense of security of we constantly allow the state to say the state must give us this particular solution. So the state comes out and says, here's free education. And we say, thank you very much. But there hasn't been enough follow-through around the policy process of that. So when you have the issue with NSFAS that you have now, NSFAS is a long-standing issue. NSFAS has been an issue since 2007 when they went essentially broke back then. Where NSFAS is at the heart of free education. Now, no one has been paying attention to NSFAS from a policy level amongst the student protesters. And the problem about that is that we're all disparate groups. If you don't have that one rallying call, there's very little reason for all of us to come together. So I think the policy interaction is low.
Is it possible to offer free tertiary education?
In this country?
Yeah.
Yes, it needs the political will.
No, do we have the money?
Yes.
We know how much universities cost, and they already subsidize all of our
students. So here's the funny thing.
All of them.
So here's the funny thing about DHET. We told DHET in 2011, 2012.
By the way, let's look at this in the greater context of the fact that basic education has failed spectacularly.
Yeah. So
we're actually creating an almost artificial, this is a made-up tertiary education situation because the primary and secondary education are a disaster. So what we're really doing is trying to make it look like we're producing students of value at the end of the process, where at the beginning we have no interest in them.
So here's a funny thing. So let me make two points. So back in 2011, 2012, we went to DHET and we said, DHET, it will cost about 40 billion rand, right, to do free education. And they laughed us away. We said, 40 billion rand in a sustainable way. Don't touch VAT. You can increase through different taxes. But VAT was like down on our list of things to do. Fast forward 5 years later, they come back with a very similar number adjusted for inflation.
Right.
But they use the VAT, which is very annoying because we thought that's not the sustainable way to
do it. But I mean, you're talking about how to spend other people's money, which is a great game to play.
So here's the reason why we would. So South Africa has this weird, weird situation.
Yeah.
So in South Africa, if you get a university degree, we have the highest return on income for a university degree in the world.
Really?
So it is one of those funny stats in the book. It's one of those bizarre stats, and it's because of the type of inequality.
So our investment turns out to be quite valuable.
Yeah. So if you get a degree in this country, now the problem is there's not enough people leaving the system with a degree because they don't leave the system because they don't have the funds to complete, right? Mm-hmm. But if you leave this university with your degree, except for a few exceptions, you usually get a job, and the return that you get over the long run is much higher. So that was our argument of, if this is the situation of inequality in our country, and university graduates are getting a huge return on their income due to having a degree, this will feed back to the system if you collect that money from students as they move up the ranks in their careers, young professionals.
You're not that's even the paying problem. Back NSFAS.
So that's the problem.
They
and that's why I say NSFAS is a huge issue. So I also track NSFAS 2007.
And also, I mean, it's always bothered me. Like, I was taught at a young age, if you get something for nothing, you probably don't really value it.
Yeah.
Right. So no, you're, it's the truth. And you're now talking about students having to pay back. I don't think that's what they want. I don't think that a lot of these student protests were about, give us the money now and we'll pay you back later. Because you can easily get a bank loan for that.
It depends. I wouldn't say all students didn't like think like that, but I would say some students did.
Okay, so
there was a mixed bag of opinion on that.
Not everybody can get a bank loan like that. So Gareth,
education,
you know, the thing about it,
easier than most.
The thing about it is there are so many sets of complexities in the intersectionality
of the layers, situation. All the layers.
Yeah, what I'm learning here, I'm all using all the big words. But the complexities are around who has access to what and how they have access to it, right?
Yeah. So well, you mentioned Kada Asmal earlier, right?
Wow, that's a deep dive.
Don't get me started.
But we have to, because we have to look at why we're at this crux now, why we've come to this problem. Mm-hmm. And we have universities that are oversubscribed because people are desperate to get in because they think that's the way that they'll make themselves.
Also, because we've built no new universities.
No new universities built, and Blade promised. My
shame.
God,
in their defense, they built like 2 ones, but they're not really efficient yet.
No. And then one of them was burnt down, so that doesn't really count.
Semi-burnt down.
Yeah. By the same people who were protesting the fees, ironically.
Shot at by... We'll talk about police at some point because they're interesting.
I mean,
they're an interesting factor.
You could argue that some of these students had legitimate concerns and were interested in finding a financial solution to their problems. And you can argue that some, just like
others.
In every protest, are looters and rioters.
All the time.
And criminals.
And also because we have been raised in this country in a way of venting our anger and frustration and protest that is violent. This is how we have been raised for years.
Still, let's not make excuses for
people. It's not an excuse. It is a reason. One of the things that we have... So I come from Soweto, you know this, right? One of the things that we know for sure in the 80s, to get attention...
You have to burn something.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. I knew what a Molotov was
when I was. but this is, you're talking about history, recent history, but in service delivery protests, this is what desperate people are doing because government doesn't listen to them.
Because we have learned, we have been taught, we have been weaned through a system that says, in order to be listened to, this is the way you have to behave, and then you
and
will
how's
be listened
that
to.
Working out for us?
So I would contend that. So I would agree that throughout history. So I must publish the book and be like, yes, it's all in the book, where I make all these arguments of South Africa's had a habit of protests, right? Because of the nature of our society, the nature of our history.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fallen over into this democratic society that we live in now. And that's how people get their voices. Our issue as the protesters was, at the beginning, we were not violent. The issue that we had was, and this is my hugest gripe with the police, was the lack of training of police officers in a tense and chaotic situation.
Sure. I mean, we
riot
had,
control.
Because
sure. And we've had people who say, you know, shoot to kill and this kind of thing.
Right? So
it's
all those attackers, and all you need is that one person. to lose their mind for just a second.
Like at Marikana.
Yeah, and it snowballs into a situation that you can't control. But the people who should be able to control that situation are the police, first and foremost. So like the union buildings. So when I was writing, I was looking at all the video footage of the union buildings. And the one starking, glaring image was six police officers looking at this gate that's being pushed down. And all I could think was, surely they'll intervene with the situation. And then 20 minutes into the, it was an E-News broadcast, I think, 20 minutes into it, surely they'll intervene at this point, because now they're climbing the trees. Then another 20 minutes, now they're using that stick, poking and prodding, and still no action. And I'm thinking, it is now an hour in, and you've watched the situation escalate. Of course it's going to blow up if you don't intervene in some way or manner. Not in a manner to squash the protest, but,
we're also talking to control it. We're talking about an elite. I mean, let's not forget this. They may not be a financial elite, but we're talking about the top maybe 2 to 5% of people in South Africa who have actually got access to university education, who are complaining about the means of that access.
Yeah.
These are people already in, Pumi. These are not people outside trying to get in.
Yeah.
We're talking about the people inside who are now... I call it struggle envy, because they've looked at the stories of the past and they've seen heroic generations before them who fought very moral and sensible and heroic causes. And they look at their own situation and they're trying to find a cause. Because very often the academic world can be very boring. And going to university isn't always a full-time business. And for a lot of these people, it's also a means of becoming politically, because a lot of people see politics as the way to making their fortune. It's a way of becoming politically relevant early on in your life.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people have gone into politics.
So I trace, one of the things I talk about is a silent revolution in this country. So people think Feesmas 4 started in 2015. I say, if there was a protest on campus that was fee-related, whether it was fees, whether it was finances, whether it was residences, I link that to a Feesmas 4 protest. And if you think of it that way, we've been doing Feesmas 4 for the past 20 years now, right? So it means there's been this general agitation within this elite group. I will call them elite, because university students in any society are an elite
group.
And even in South Africa, there's an elite group within that elite group, which I talk about called coconuts, which is another interesting
term. It's very pejorative. Term.
Yeah. But in an interesting way. But this elite also function as what they believe the valve. Of if this small elite within the universities, in particular previously disadvantaged universities, leave, they open a valve for others, right? If everyone believes our American dream, because this is what it really is, our American dream is get to university. And once you're in university, then go get your job. That is the valve that everyone believes. So it is an elite saying, we're the elite of the poor. Because that's what it is. And previously disadvantaged universities were the...
And they're more than happy to point themselves spokespersons of the poor without checking with them.
Elite. Well, sometimes they do. But previously disadvantaged universities are a lot better than previously advantaged universities. So Fort Hare University is a lot better at communicating with the community than a UCT would be. Right. So when they say we're advocating...
A much better relationship.
A much better relationship.
A historical relationship, which is much better.
Yeah. And they will say, we're advocating for change in our community. And it's this very different narrative compared to previously advantaged universities. So you see, for them, it's opening the valve for others. Now, you can open the valve for others, but if there's no water coming through basic education, then there's a mixed
bag of opinion. That's the problem we were talking about earlier. Yeah. Look, I want to talk to you some more, because we're scratching the surface. And I didn't budget, unlike Tito, I didn't budget enough time for this. We've got to talk about the medium-term budget, and I've got to get our guest after 8 in here, and it's already 3 minutes to. So listen, Hotsi, we're going to have to get you back. Thank you for coming. Fantastic. Congrats on the book.
Thanks a lot. It is called
Breaking a Rainbow, Building a Nation. And I think it would be interesting reading to anyone who is – I mean, I think we should all be interested in what's going on in student politics and what's happened in student political activity in the last couple of years. So thank you for the book. Well done.
Yeah.
And we'll get you in again. Yes, of course.
Yeah, 30th of October, book launch, Santon Exclusive Books at 6 o'clock. If you want to hear me say this in person or come attack me.
Absolutely.
I'm always up for it.
Good. I like that you don't invite attack. I don't want anyone to attack you.
Not attack. Like – arguments.
Don't invite attack.
We
want to have people like debate vigorously. We want to encourage people to deal with each other in a civil way. If you don't like what Hotsi says, then please don't talk to him or send him an email. Don't attack him on Twitter.
Angry emails are the worst.
Yeah, but don't attack him on Twitter and don't go to his book launch unless you're going to support him.
Don't attack.
Yeah, don't attack.
Engage.
Right. Thank you very much.
There we go.
one.
All right. We've got to talk to Anthea Gardner. We've got to talk about the medium-term budget that was tabled yesterday by our new finance minister of only, what, a week or two old, Tito Mboweni. But he's been there before, so he knows this like the back of his hand. And she's on – is she on the phone or on Skype? On the phone. Oh, that's not the phone. That doesn't sound like the phone at all. Let's get to Anthea and see what she has to say. Of course, Tito giving his first speech here as the Minister of Finance, and at a particularly precipitous time if you consider what's going on in the books of government on the income and on the expenditure side. Am I right, Anthea? Tough business.
Hi, Gareth.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Cool. I was just saying that Tito has a tough job here, and how do you think he performed?
So there were no real big surprises in the budget yesterday. I mean, I think the word of the day was probably reprioritization. That was kind of everything he said was about taking money from here to put it there, to focus on other things. He definitely wants to focus on growth, no doubt about it. We can all sigh a sigh of relief, though. No increase in personal income or corporate tax or VAT, which of course means that if he is going to reprioritize or if he is going to keep kind of growing the economy, which is what he seems to want to do, then he's going to have to borrow more money. And I think that was not a huge surprise, but not great. Our debt to GDP is growing. It's looking to stabilize at about 60%. What you really want is around 50% or below 50%.
Right.
But then again, Moody's had predicted this a couple of weeks ago, and they said, okay, well, if you tell us it's going to be at 60% and you can manage it at 60%, then that's fine. You know, what you don't want at this stage now is a big shock to the rand, because as we know, the interest payments, especially from foreign borrowing, so kind of when we borrow in U.S. dollars, is already enormous. But if it stays, if things stay as they are, then I think we'll be fine. So the big kind of thing he said, that he was zero rating white bread, flour, cake flour, and sanitary pads, and I think he got a big applause from all the women in the audience.
He should have got applause from everybody, but this pretty much makes it a tax-cutting budget, right? I mean, all of these exceptions.
Exactly. And then you can imagine that if he's cutting taxes, his revenue falls, and so he has to borrow, as I was saying. I mean, we're already on about a 50 billion rand shortfall over what was projected. Mm-hmm. And then the real disappointment, I mean, I think, although it's disappointing, but it's not that we didn't know it was going to happen. SAA is receiving another 5 billion rand. The post office is receiving 2.9 billion rand. SANRAL is getting 5.8 billion rand. And it was really funny. Peter kind of gave us a bit of a lecture, didn't he? He kind of went, well, listen, if you want to use the roads, then you must pay your e-toll.
Well, he sounded a little bit, if that's how he put it, he sounds a little bit like those old men who you encountered say, the problem with your generation is. And this is the problem with Tito, is he represents a much older ANC than the one that's been in power for the last 10 years.
But he does understand how the economy works, though. Mm-hmm. And you've got to give him credit for that. So, If it's a lecture we need, then I guess that's what we need to take.
And we do have to swallow some bitter pills. But he also referred to how government has to shrink and how government needs to get up to speed with how much it spends on salaries, where the wastage is occurring. Did he refer to the state-owned enterprises?
So the only kind of state-owned – yes, he definitely did. I mean, the state-owned enterprises, he said, they need to be reconfigured. And he said we should keep an open mind, which is interesting because he mentioned possibly an equity partner. And in particular SAA's case, he said that they may have to close certain businesses. Now, you know how we've been comparing ComAir to SAA, and it really is going the other way, right? So he's saying, SAA, you need to shrink. Where we're looking at a private airline like ComAir, which is growing and diversifying into other areas, to kind of hedge themselves against the oil price and expenditure growth, which exogenous expenditure growth, which they can't control. So the question, I guess, is will he want to privatize SAA, for example? I think he wouldn't be opposed to it, actually.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting...
As you said, As you said about the public services wage bill, he said, yeah, that definitely exceeded budget by far too much, $30.2 billion. But he lectured them as well, and he said, you know, you have to absorb costs. You're not getting any more money, basically. And he said, even though the cabinet is the prerogative of the president, preferably it shouldn't be more than 25, probably only 20. So I think Cyril probably is working quite closely with him, and they've had these discussions. I don't think he would have said it without consulting with the president himself. And so hopefully we'll see some changes going forward.
All right. Are there any things about this budget that make you very concerned? Are there any things about it that make you very happy? I mean, you were hoping for stability. Is that what you got?
Yes. No, it's fine. As far as I'm concerned, look, it's not great, and the bond sold off and the rand certainly weakened. It's not fantastic, but it was never going to be fantastic. The widening of the budget deficit and debt to GDP is a concern, because our debt to GDP will grow to 55.8 because we can't get money in, so we're having to borrow, and it will stabilize around 60%. So that's not great. But if we can stick to that and not go over it, I think we should be fine. It'll be interesting to see what Moody's says about this. You know, National Treasury are now expecting a lower GDP growth than they were before, I think 0.7% for this year.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing compared to the NDP's projected 5%, I don't know how many years ago, right?
Right.
And, of course, lower growth means lower revenue income, and that's a problem. But other than that, pretty much, it's okay. I think we'll be fine.
He said some things about the renewal of that partnership between the private sector and government, which is encouraging, because for many of the finance ministers that had come before him, that was absolutely not a priority. And obviously, if there isn't a good relationship between the private sector and government, then everything falls apart. There isn't revenue, there aren't jobs created, there isn't necessarily the sustainability across both public and private platforms that we require in order to grow this economy.
Exactly, absolutely. And one of the things he particularly mentioned in that area was healthcare. You know, so definitely, again, this kind of reprioritization of 350 million rand to recruit 2,000 more health professionals.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely got the right thinking. I just don't know how he's going to manage. And I heard talk that he might not stay around for too long, but I kind of hope he does, because he does seem to have a good handle, even though it's only been 2 weeks or whatever the case may be. He does seem to have a fairly good handle on the budget and what needs to be done in the economy to grow the economy. Because he opened his speech by saying, we have low growth and high unemployment, and this is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then he referred, you know, to kind of spending on the IPP and spending on infrastructure, on agriculture, industrial parks. So, yeah, I think his focus is right.
All right, Anthea, thank you very much for giving us some of your time this morning, and we'll continue to talk about this on Monday in the Money Shot.
Pleasure, guys. Have a good rest of the week.
Thank you very much, Anthea Gardner, and a little mini Money Shot after budget medium-term discussions yesterday with Tito. Tips for Tito. Shane Pumi just let me know that our guest Hotsi's, is it his uncle? It's his uncle who died. I didn't even know this, and had I known when we started talking to him.
Yeah, but his dad just tweeted that. Like,
his dad just tweeted it now? Okay, so it might even have been news to him. I don't know if we wanted to be the ones to break it to him anyway, so there we are. Ambassador Mos Chikane, who died. So there's some sad news, and our condolences to the family on that front. If you want to hear what we were talking about in the first hour, I at length discussed, and because it affected me so much, the death of our friend HP. I think the whole country very upset about that, and certainly the music community, anybody who knew him, our condolences go to everybody in that community as well. And we will be joining Pieter Dirk Eys, one of my favorite people, a real national treasure, a man who's written a book called The Echo of a Noise, his own memoir. And I can't wait to see him. I can't wait to talk to him again. It's always such a privilege to have him here. So he's going to be joining us in a moment. Stick around. Pumi, thank you so much. It was lovely to see you again.
So much fun. So early
Very good.
In the morning.
And I love that Pumelele and I have argued and laughed and fought and debated for years, and now we can share some of that with you in a short 2-hour segment today. May there be many more, Pum.
Thank you for inviting me. This was so much fun. Thank you, Sia. Sia also called me at the crack of dawn.
You said you didn't enjoy the waking up part of it, but we enjoyed having you, so thank you. All right. Pieter Dirk Ace next, everybody. Stick around. The un-news. Let me do that quickly for you to let you know what's going on in that respect. You can't leave that stuff out. It's important. Do you want to know the un-news, Pums?
Yes.
All right. Pieter Dirk Ace coming up just after this. Here's the important stuff. All right. First things first. Bill Clinton had a shock yesterday when it was discovered a bomb was sent to him. Turns out there was a typo in the package. It was meant for Bill Cosby. And since discovering the error, Camille has been very apologetic. Tito Mboweni ruffled feathers yesterday when he said the cabinet should be smaller. Much smaller. Deputy Minister of Government Brian Stellations, as well as the Deputy Minister of Social Aspirations and Turning Up, were both very, very upset about this. They even referred to it as unconstitutional. And finally, it's the Curry Cup final weekend with that nostalgic rugby fans across South Africa will come out of the woodwork to enjoy this spectacle. Of course, most South Africans think the Curry Cup is something that politicians used to drink out of at the Saxon World Shebeen. But no, it turns out it was an actual sporting event. And this weekend, you can get a little nostalgic too. Pieter Dirk Ace, next on CliffCentral.com. And don't miss that. He's always an absolute pleasure to talk to. All of that and more on the way. CliffCentral.com.